in chapter 12. We're continuing our study on the life of David as we see it played out in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. And we've probably just got a couple more weeks left in this study. We're nearing the end. And this was one of those difficult weeks for me where it wasn't quite as clear, it wasn't quite as cut and dry as it has been in previous weeks as far as direction, where we should go, and what just what direction we should go in. And I've, anytime I come to a long-term study like this, I come across commentators who, you know, really excel in one particular book or one particular biography. And I tend to lean heavily on those certain people, and they're kind of my go-to people through studies like this. And it was the same for Corinthians and Ezra and all these things that we've gone through. And when I got to this particular text that we're going to look at this morning, it's like all of a sudden the light kind of dimmed greatly from these go-to folks. And really, even, you know, at that point, I start to say, okay, well, you know, we got to dig a little deeper. We got to look a little harder here. And even Thursday afternoon, I'm still just reading this text and reading this text and reading this text and saying, I don't know, maybe we just skip over it and go somewhere else. And then I believe it was Thursday evening, as I was thinking about this, another text just came to me, and in a flash, all these pieces started coming together. And so hopefully it makes sense to you all, and hopefully you all find it beneficial as I did once I began to put these pieces together. And so I'll start to make that connection in just a moment, but let me first just say a couple things by way of review, because what we're going to look at today has a lot to do with what we saw last week. And what we saw last week was one of two big, well-known events in David's life. I said last week that typically when you go to the average person and say, tell me what you know about David of the Old Testament. Well, most people would, you know, the first thing they would say is, well, I know about David and Goliath. Okay, good. That's probably the first big thing. The second big thing that they would probably say is, well, I know that David, you know, sinned with Bathsheba and he was guilty of adultery and then guilty of murder. Like, those are the two big things that people know about David. And so when you go about and you start talking about David as being a man after God's own heart, they say, wait a second. You know, I know one good thing about David and one really bad thing about David, and yet you're saying that he's a man after God's own heart. And the pattern that we've been taking, and I hope that you've picked up on this, is that when we look at David as a man after God's own heart, that doesn't just mean that we look at the high points in David's life. It doesn't just mean that we look at the times in David's life where he did things right. Because a lot of the times, what we can gain from looking at David and looking at the things that he went through is how he responded to maybe God's hand of chastening, how he responded to correction, how he responded to rebuke, how he finally comes to points in his life where he says, you know, I got nothing left. I don't know what to do. I can't continue on. Oh, maybe I should call on the Lord. You know, it's so typical of the Christian. You know, this is us. We're up, we're down, we're in sweet fellowship with the Lord, and then we let things get in the way, and then we try hard to do things ourselves, and we try harder and we try harder till finally we come to a point and we say, you know, maybe I should ask the Lord for help. Maybe I should have done that from the very beginning. That's the life of David. It's the life of us. So we stopped last week after looking at Nathan's delivering to David God's judgment, God's consequences that were going to come as a result of this great sin that he had committed. And so let me read these consequences here, and then we're going to move forward, and we're going to see how they start to play out in David's life. So 2 Samuel chapter 12, starting in verse 10, This is again Nathan talking to David. He says, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." And then verse 14 through 18. "However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." So Nathan went to his house, and then the Lord struck the child that Uriah's widow bore to David, so that he was very sick. David therefore inquired of God for the child, and David fasted and went and lay all night on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not eat food with them. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died. And so David has all of these consequences put before him. And then not long after those consequences are handed to him, he sees them begin to take place. One of the first things that Nathan said was going to happen is that the child that was going to be born as a result of David's sin with Bathsheba was going to die. And that doesn't keep David from praying that, you know, God would change his mind, but we see that doesn't happen. David prays and David fasts for 7 days. And in the end, the child still dies. And that's just the beginning of a very bad place for David. A very bad place for David. And so that's where we left off last week. And again, you know, unfortunately for David, this is just the beginning of his coming woes. And so what I want us to see today, as these events play out and as these events unfold in David's life, is how he learns a New Testament truth that we would see in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. And that verse says that we reap what we sow. That's one of the first things I think that David will come to understand through this time. You reap what you sow. The second thing that David's going to learn is that when you sow to please your sinful nature, from that nature you are going to reap destruction. And that's what, for the next several chapters, which represent the next several years in David's life, he is going to reap destruction. And yet, even through that destruction, even through what that you stand back and you say, these are the worst times of David's life. When we get through this, I want to go back and I want to show you that even in these difficult times, the worst of David's life, you still see the hand of God on David's life. You still see God fulfilling, working behind the scenes. Remember that word providence. You still see God doing this to fulfill the covenant that he had made with David back in chapter 7. You remember that? Back in chapter 7, God says, I'm gonna, you know, your household is going to endure and your kingdom's gonna go forever. And he's promising these blessings way down the line. And that sounds, you know, what the judgment pronounced on him in chapter 12 sounds like a complete contradiction to everything that God had promised him in chapter 7. But we'll come back and we'll make that connection at the end. So the sequence of events leading up to his darkest days, they begin almost immediately with the death of that baby, just like Nathan said it was going to happen. And if you go through and you read this book in great detail, you know, it's become a Hollywood thing to make movies out of biblical events now, and they don't do a very good job at it. But, you know, if they were to make a mini-series about 2 Samuel, chances are most of us wouldn't watch it unless they cut a lot of stuff out. I mean, there's some pretty real stuff in here. And you see that when you start here in chapter 13, and I'm going to paraphrase a lot of this because it's just so much material for us to cover. David's family is kind of like the Brady Bunch times 10, okay? You go through and David has all of these wives and they all have sons and daughters, and you know, the Brady Bunch, you saw in that show how, you know, people get on each other's nerves and stomp on each other's feelings and stuff like that. Well, you multiply that by like 10 and you've got a whole just mess. You know, to say that David's family was dysfunctional would be a tremendous understatement, and you'll see it here in chapter 13. We're focused in on two of David's children in particular, Amnon and Tamar. And as the text tells us, Amnon, the boy, loved, okay, I'm going to put that in quotations, loved Tamar. Tamar wanted nothing to do with Amnon, okay? And remember, they're like half siblings here, so this is weird. So Amnon devises this plan, and when the plan is executed, it ends up with him raping Tamar, okay? Again, I said if this was a miniseries, you probably wouldn't want to watch it. And then wanting absolutely nothing to do with her, just shunning her and saying, you know, kind of, well, you know, at this point, according to the law, I mean, what, she's really kind of shunned at that point. But she has another brother, a full brother named Absalom, who then takes her in and begins to take care of her. Now, Absalom and Tamar are full siblings, okay? Same mother, same father. And so it's natural that Absalom is gonna kind of stand up here and be the good brother. Well, you can imagine that Absalom has a little bit of issue with what Amnon has done. And so Absalom kind of falls back into the shadows and begins to plot. He begins to plan this, I don't know, vigilante justice, I guess you could say. And he's very patient about it, okay? Time goes by, and you know, David knows that this has happened, and as the king, you know, he's responsible to do something about it as the king. He's also responsible to do something about it as a father, and yet we see him kind of sitting back not doing anything about it. And so Absalom's going to take matters into his own hands. And Absalom eventually, he kills Amnon in retaliation and then flees to a city of refuge. And so just here in this short text, David has lost one son. Actually, he's lost two sons. He lost his baby. Now he's lost his son Amnon. And now his son Absalom has taken on the role of fugitive and has sought refuge in another city with a distant relative. And so you can see that things are beginning to unravel for David. You go on to the next chapter, and David is essentially tricked into letting Absalom come back home and pronouncing a judgment that protects him from anyone else's retaliation. And if David had been heartbroken over what had occurred in these last few years and these last couple chapters with his family, he's really about to get an eye-opener, because this son Absalom, who he loves so dearly, has his eyes set on a number of things that belong to his father. And one of those things is his throne. Now, is this starting to sound like a soap opera or a Greek tragedy yet? All right. This is the magnitude of what's playing out in David's life. And so Absalom, I think, gives us a picture of the prodigal son gone wrong. You know, Luke 15, we have that incredible picture of the prodigal son who you know, takes what's rightfully his from his father and goes out and squanders it and then says, man, I made a pretty bad decision. And he comes back and the father welcomes him back. And, you know, he kind of does that to an extent. He goes out, he kills one of his brothers, and then he's tricked into being welcomed back. And that's not enough for him. And so then he sets out to take his father's throne. He never really came to his senses like the prodigal. He never repented of his wrongdoing. And so once he's given freedom to come home and he's given protection from retaliation, he begins to scheme and he begins to build up a following of people. Look here at chapter 15 now, starting in verse 1. It says, now it came about after this, talking about after David had made this, allowed for him to come back and you know, not pronounced any judgment on him. After this came about, Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on part of the king." So do you see what Absalom's doing here? He's kind of gone into politician mode. And he says, "I'm going to put myself before the people and I'm going to make myself sound really good." So he goes to the city gate. At this particular time, if people have a discrepancy, they go and they take it before the king, and the king hears their case and the king pronounces judgment. Absalom goes to the city gate and he cuts people off as they're coming in. He says, he goes on and he says, verse 4, "Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice.' And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment." So, get this. "So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men in Israel." All these people from different tribes are coming to the king so that the king can hear their story. The king can pronounce judgment. Absalom goes and sets himself at the gate. He sees them coming. "Hey, folks, where are you from? You know, how's it going? Oh, you got a problem. Tell me about your problem." "Oh, my gosh, I can't even believe that. Oh, man, that's a shame that you're not going to get justice, because the king, he doesn't have anything set up. He doesn't have anything in place where anybody's going to hear your calls." Man, that's such a shame. I tell you what, if I was king, I'd deliver some justice. If I was king, I would hear your calls and I would pronounce judgment. You know what? Let me help you up off the ground. Let me dust you off. That's what Absalom does. And the scripture also tells us that Absalom was a very handsome man. There was no defect in him. He had long flowing hair that he cut once a year. And Absalom, very slowly, over a period of about 4 years, begins to win the hearts of men. Skip down to verse 13. "Then a messenger came to David saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom.'" Now, this is not the first time that David's throne has been challenged. Okay, we've seen this happen before. Basically, what Absalom does when he feels like he has a good handle on things, he goes before David and he says, "Dad, you know, I made a covenant a long time ago. I need to go back and I need to honor that covenant." And so David says, "Okay, yeah, go ahead and do that." He goes out and he starts spreading the word. And he says, "Hey, when the time is right, you guys pronounce, you know, Absalom is king. We're going to follow Absalom." You know, he's doing all this stuff behind the scenes. Well, it happens. He goes out. He starts telling people, "Okay, you know, rise up, you're with me, you're with me, you're with me." And word reaches David here in verse 13. A messenger comes to David. He says, "The hearts of the men are with Absalom." And so David said to all his servants who are with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape Absalom." This is a very, you know, one minute things are good. I mean, he's down in the dumps about what's going on, but just like that, his throne is being taken from him and he is forced to flee. He says, "Go in haste or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." Then the king's servant said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king chooses." So David, right off the get-go, acknowledges that they're in a pretty bad place. And he says, "We've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here quickly." If you look at verse 25 and 26, he acknowledges that he isn't quite sure how this event is going to play out. He says, "If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say, 'Thus I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me as seems good to him.'" So, you know, you really see this acknowledgement from David at this point that he's kind of just stepping back and saying, "Okay, I'm going to put this in God's hand, and if he sees fit to bring me back, then good. If he sees fit to not bring me back, then, you know, whatever happens, happens." And he makes that statement in response to his servants wanting to go and take the ark with them. And in telling them no to send it back to Jerusalem, I think it further illustrates David's surrender to the will of God in this trial. He desires that the priestly activities and the feasts and the offerings and all those things must remain intact in Jerusalem. He's not seeking to take it and thus the presence of God with him. The second thing he does as he's leaving is he prays to the Lord for intervention. So he submits himself to the will of God, I think. But he also goes before the Lord and he prays for the Lord's intervention. Verse 30 says, "And David went up the ascent to the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, and his head was covered and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Now someone told David, saying, 'Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom.'" Now this is bad news for David, okay? The bad news continues. Not only is his son, whom he loves, Absalom, seeking to take his throne, but one of his most beloved advisors, a man named Ahithophel, has joined with Absalom's cause. He's come to a point and he's weighed both sides and he says, man, Absalom really seems to have this following. So I'm going to jump ship before it ever catches fire and I'm going to join with Absalom's party. And that's devastating news to David. And so David, at that point, when he hears that, listen to this request that he makes. He says, "Oh Lord, Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." You see, Ahithophel was a very wise man. He was a very good advisor. And David understands that with his counsel, man, Absalom's going to be even more difficult to defeat. And so he prays to God and he says, "Make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." And folks, it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long for this prayer to be answered. Verse 32, they go on. "It happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped that, behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head." And it sounds like Hushai wants to join with the party. "David, you and your guys are leaving. I'm going to come with you." Now, Hushai is another one of David's very wise, very trusted advisors. And he is still loyal to David. He wants to come along with them. Listen to what David says. Verse 33, he says, "If you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me." You know, maybe Hushai's old, maybe he's got a walker or a cane or something. And David says, "You're just going to hold us up. You know, if you want to come with us, you're just going to be a burden." Verse 34, he says, but if you return to the city and you say to Absalom, "I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I'll be your servant." Then, he says, "you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me." So David pits two of his great advisors against each other. This is, you know, he says, "God, please thwart the counsel of Ahithophel." Oh, here's Hushai. "Hushai, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go back and I want you to submit yourself to Absalom." And so basically, he's sending him in to kind of do some counterterrorism stuff. And he sends him into hostile territory and says, "Submit yourself to Absalom and say that you want to be one of his advisors." So David's on his way out. Absalom is on his way in. And now, as he's coming to a point where he can begin to rule, he has to make a decision regarding how he's going to deal with David and the people who support David. Now, he's young, he's green, he doesn't know what he's doing, he's got a lot of enthusiasm, and so what does he do? He looks around and he says, "I've got Ahithophel over here, and he was a great advisor for my dad. Let me sit down and let me ask Ahithophel what I should do." And this was the moment that David had prayed for. He knew that Absalom would turn to Ahithophel for counsel. And his prayer was that it would be foolishness. And it turns out that, man, Ahithophel's plan is anything but foolishness. It's a great plan in Absalom's mind. Chapter 17 now, starting in verse 1. And this is the second part of Ahithophel's plan. If you go back into the end of chapter 16, the first part of Ahithophel's plan to Absalom is, and I realize that there's a lot of people, a lot of names, so you know, bear with me. The first part of Ahithophel's plan to Absalom was that he go and he lie with David's concubines that he had left behind. You know, David in his rush did not take all of those ladies with him. And so Ahithophel says, Absalom, what you need to do is you need to go lie with your father's concubines. Well, gee, where have I heard that before? Oh, that was part of the judgment pronounced back in chapter 12. And so Absalom says, yeah, that's a pretty good idea, Ahithophel. I think I'll go do that. What was the point in doing that? Well, the scripture says that Ahithophel says, once that happens, you know, then everybody's going to know that you have, the word is, you have become odious to your father. I think Ahithophel has this mentality that, you know, Absalom, you need to make sure that everybody knows that you're for real, that you're not messing around, that you're not concerned about, you know, you don't care. You're your own man. You're going to go out there. You're going to do what you want to do. That's the first part of Ahithophel's counsel. So you can say at that point, Absalom is probably like, cool, yeah, that's a great idea. I'll go do that. The second part of his counsel, it gets better from there. He says, furthermore, Ahithophel says to Absalom, please let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. So the second part of the counsel is, Absalom, you don't even have to come along. You don't even have to make the pursuit. You stay here. You know, live the dream a little bit. I'm going to take care of this. He says, I'm going to come upon them while they're weary and they're exhausted, and I will terrify him so that all the people who are with him are going to flee. And then I will strike down the king alone, and I will bring back all the people to you. The return of everyone depends on the man that you seek. Then all the people will be at peace. That's a pretty good plan in Absalom's mind. It's also a pretty good plan in the minds of the elders of Israel. It says, verse 4, this plan pleased Absalom, and it also pleased the elders of Israel. Sounds like pretty solid advice. The elders agree. David fled quickly because he expected a quick pursuit. He knew that time was of the essence, and so this counsel was definitely not good news for David and his supporters. However, David had already given this matter over to the Lord, hadn't he? He had already prayed that the Lord would intervene if it's what he desired. And David was resting in whatever it was that God had purposed to do. And so Ahithophel gives this fantastic counsel. It pleases Absalom. It pleases the other elders. But Absalom says, I've also got Hushai here, who's another pretty solid advisor. I'll get a second opinion on that. So he calls in Hushai, again, very good friend of David, former advisor. And it was known to everybody that Hushai was a very loyal person to David. So they bring Hushai in. Hushai gets briefed on the advice that Ahithophel gave and then is put on the spot to offer his own advice. And this is what he says. Go down to verse 7. So Hushai said to Absalom, this time the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good. So he acknowledges that, man, Ahithophel is a great advisor. He's given plenty of good advice in the past. But he says, this time the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good. Moreover, Hushai says, you know your father and his men, that they're mighty men and that they're fierce like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is an expert in warfare, and he's not going to spend the night with the people. Behold, he's now hidden himself in one of the caves or in another place. And it will be when he falls on them at the first attack that whoever hears it will say, there has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. Folks, it's important to remember here that David has made a living out of, you know, living in caves and being on the run and operating in stealth mode. He says, you go down there and you try and descend on them. The next thing you're going to know, you're going to look around and say, where are my 12,000 men? You know, they've already been slaughtered. He says, you can't do that. These guys are seasoned. These guys are good. Verse 10, he says, even the one who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will completely lose heart. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. But I counsel that all Israel be surely gathered to you, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that is by the sea in abundance, and that you personally go into battle. And so what's Hushai's counsel? You know, his counsel is not small and stealthy. His counsel is, let's bring the whole party. Let's get everybody together. You know, as much as there's sand on the seashore, let's get everybody together. And then we'll go and we'll crush them. He goes on. He says, so we shall come to him in one of the places where he can be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and of all the men who are with him, not even one will be left. And if he withdraws into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will drag it into the valley until not even a small stone is found there. And you know, if anybody doubted Hushai's loyalty to Absalom, they're sitting here thinking, wow, this dude, man, he's for real. Because Hushai is just given this counsel that's like, we are going to just obliterate them. If we have to pull a city to the ground to do it, then we'll do that. That's Hushai's counsel. And I'm sure everybody's kind of thinking, oh, okay. Verse 14, then Absalom and all of the men of Israel said, get this, they say the counsel of Hushai is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. You see what just happened there, folks? You've got these two advisors that are put against each other, and man, it seems like on paper one of them might be a little more solid. Well, he was more solid. You know, if you're looking at things from Absalom's perspective, man, Ahithophel's, his advice is, man, spot on. You go now, you're going to have victory. They're on the run, they're tired, they've got no supplies. Strike while the iron's hot. And Hushai says, let's take our time. Let's get the word out. Let's get everybody together, you know, get the band back together. Then we'll go after them, and we won't stop until we get them. And all Hushai is doing is giving them time. Time's all they need. You've got all these are seasoned warriors. They're mighty men, men of valor. All they need is a little time and a firm place to stand, and good luck, you know. That's what Hushai seeks to do. And so his counsel is chosen above the counsel of Ahithophel. And folks, if you think, you know, that was coincidence or happenstance, I'll tell you what, that's the Lord's hand, the Lord's providence. You know, it says at the end of verse 14, for the Lord had ordained, okay, to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel. It's even acknowledged there. Ahithophel's counsel was great, but the Lord ordained to thwart it. Why? So that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. The whole time, this was all part of the plan. And you know what I think from David's perspective? I think that one of the most devastating things for David here is that almost everything that has gone on to this time has sounded like a direct contradiction to that Davidic covenant back in chapter 7. You know? Talking about how great his kingdom is, how his kingdom's going to endure, how great his family's going to be. And what's David left to think about? David's at the run, on the run. He's not in his kingdom. He's been displaced. His own son wants to kill him, you know? His own son wants to take the throne. That sure doesn't sound like, you know, the Davidic promise that was made in chapter 7. Yet we've seen so far God's providence. We've seen so far the hand of the Lord working behind the scenes, and it doesn't stop there. So this stage has been set. Ahithophel, who really had the best approach, is ignored thanks to the grace of God. Hushai's battle plan is adopted, and again, that really allows David and his men time to flee, to rest, to rejuvenate, to prepare themselves for battle. It's funny, if you read this text, they get out there and all these different people start bringing them supplies and start bringing them food. And it's like, you know, you're back with the Israelites in the wilderness, and there's manna falling from heaven and water coming from a rock. All this provision is made for these guys, and they have time. Time to rest, time to form a plan, time to rejuvenate, and it all has to do with God working behind the scenes through Hushai against Ahithophel. Now we go over to chapter 18, and we're just about through with this. The battle lines are drawn. David issues commands to his commanders. And this time he's willing to go out with them. He's going to go out in battle. And they say, no. They say, you stay here. They're not coming to pursue us. They're coming to pursue you. So you stay here. You stay safe. You know, we'll go out and we'll take care of this. And so David says, okay. And then as these men are leaving to go to battle, he says, guys, you know, when you see Absalom, will you deal gently with him for my sake? Will you deal gently with him for my sake? And that's a curious statement, isn't it? That is a curious statement. You know, yes, he's his son, but don't you think by this point he might have put that behind him at least a little bit? You know, now that this young man's coming after him and wants him dead and, you know, has defiled his wives in front of all of those that are around, he says, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Well, let me tell you, that falls on deaf ears because David's the only one who cares the first thing about Absalom. Everybody else is thinking, you know, we've been displaced from our homes, we've been displaced from our families, and it's because this little punk kid thinks that he's entitled to something, so he's pursuing us. Yet David makes that request, deal gently with Absalom for my, you know, and what, maybe David makes this request because of that father-son relationship. Maybe that's what it is. That probably has something to do with it. Maybe that's not everything, but I'd say it's at least part of it. Maybe David thinks back to the covenant that God made with him, and he sees Absalom as being the one whom God spoke of, the one whom, you know, God was going to raise up and God was going to be in fellowship with, and he was the one who was going to build God a house. You know, and so maybe he's thinking that and saying, you know what, if we do this now, then we're going to thwart God's plan, and you know what's going to happen then. Maybe he's just saying that because he's not completely trusted in the counsel of God. I don't know exactly what it is, but nonetheless, he gives that command and he says, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." Now I'm going to read here, starting in verse 6 of chapter 18. It says, "Then the people went on to the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great." Okay, so it wasn't even a question. 20,000 men. "For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside." And get this, "The forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured." You know that blessing of time that David and his men had? They had time to go and set up and say, you know what, this is exactly where we want to fight this battle. We know the land, we know the terrain, we know the forest. These people, they're just going to come in there doing all this. And it made it so much easier for them. It said the forest devoured more people than the swords of David and his men. Verse 9, "Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. For Absalom was riding on his mule." And folks, you can't make this stuff up. "The mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the tree." You picture that? Absalom's trucking it on a mule, and his head gets caught in the branches of a tree. And the mule keeps going on, and he's stuck there with his head stuck in this tree. Verse 10, "When a certain man saw it, he told Joab," who is one of the commanders, one of the leaders of David's men. And he said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Then Joab said to the man who told him, "Now behold, you saw him? Why did you not strike him to the ground? I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." Whoop-dee. You know, Joab is very passionate that Absalom, he needs to get what's coming to him. But you know what? Everybody else, it wasn't just the commanders that heard David say, "Deal gently with Absalom for my sake." It filtered to everybody. And this young man, he says, "I'm not going to do it. No, sir, I'm not going to go against the king's orders, and I'm not going to kill this young man. Joab was not nearly as concerned about what the king wanted. He takes a handful of spears and starts throwing them, and him and his armor bearers eventually kill Absalom. They find a big hole in the ground. They chuck him in there and cover it with rocks. And that's the end of that. That's the end of that uprising. And when they blow the horn and the battle is won, everybody comes back and everybody's excited, at least on the winning side, on David's side. Everybody's excited. And you know what David wants to know? All that David wants to know is, what about Absalom? Tell me about Absalom. Did Absalom live? Is Absalom still alive? You know, and then eventually he hears the news that Absalom has been killed, and he's just absolutely, he doesn't care a thing about the battle. He doesn't care a thing about the fact that he's, you know, going to be restored to his throne. He's just absolutely crushed by the news of his son. Tough times for David, huh? Tough times for David. You think about all of these events unfolding and all of the trouble and all of the trial and all of the heartache and all of the sleepless nights. And you know, a lot of us would sit back in that position and we would say, man, where did we go wrong? Did we go wrong when we weren't a good parent to Absalom? Did we go wrong when we, you know, didn't step in here when we should have? You know where David went wrong? He went wrong when he never went to battle when he should have been in battle. He went wrong when he didn't look away when he should have looked away. When he sowed to please his sinful nature, from that he reaped destruction. Folks, do you think David learned the truth of Galatians 6, 7, and 8 in this awful time in his life? Maybe some of you have been there before. Maybe some of you have made a decision and it's led to all of these consequences and you beat yourself up over it and you beat yourself up over it. God never took his hand off David. Were there consequences? Yeah, there were consequences. Did those consequences bring David to the worst time of his life? Yeah. You know, did he put his consequences up against what God had promised and maybe say, oh man, you know, maybe God's gone back on his promises? Did he ever think that? I don't know. I would be inclined to think maybe he did. Maybe he did. Let me jump back for just a second to chapter 12. There's just a little snippet thrown in here. When everything else is going wrong for David, his family's falling apart, his kingdom is falling apart, probably his understanding of this promise that God has made with him is just crumbling, dissolving, whatever it was he thought. Listen to this. Chapter 12, verse 24. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. Now the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet, and he named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. When everything else around David was falling apart, God never took his hand off of him. God never forgot the promise that he had made to him. I'm just inclined to think that David's attitude toward Absalom had everything to do with, he probably thought that he was the one that God had talked about in that covenant. And all the while, we know we have the ability to go back and we know about Solomon. And we know how Solomon was the one who was spoken about in the Davidic covenant and the Davidic promise. And so even in the midst of all this other stuff, God is working behind the scenes, his providence, working together everything that needed to happen in order to fulfill what he had promised to David. Was it easy for David? No, absolutely not. Do you think David maybe finally came to a point where he said, you know what, I really blew it. And I'm going to endure the consequences of it, and maybe God won't, you know, take his hand off of me in the end. And he doesn't. He doesn't. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, again, this is such an unusual text. All of these things taking place in David's life. You know, I won't even begin to stand up here and hammer home application for this text, because I think it means something different to every single one of us. Some of us have been in David's position. We've been in David's place where it looks like we're just absolutely at rock bottom and there's nowhere else to go, and we've messed up too bad, and, you know, surely God's turned away from us and he's left us to deal with things on our own. Father, if that's us this morning, Lord, just help us to see that we can go back and we can look at this story and see how your hand is still on David. And you're faithful to David, even when it seems like everything's just coming down around him. You're still taking care of him. You're still opening doors for him to go through. And you have not gone back on the promise that you made. Father, help us to see that this morning. Help us to understand that you are a God of promises and your promises are true. That you're faithful to make good on those promises. And Father, on the other hand, I pray that we would just have the truth of Galatians 6, 7, and 8 on our hearts, Lord. That when we're faced with decisions, that we would weigh and really think and just question what it is that we're sowing. Are we sowing things that are going to be pleasing to you, that are going to bring forth life? Or are we sowing things that are pleasing to us, pleasing to the flesh, from which we're going to reap destruction? Lord, help us to be mindful of those decisions in our lives. We pray these things in your name. Amen.